So Steve is going to talk on UKIP, the BNP in blazers,
Well, briefly, where did I get that from? I was at Trafalgar Square on May Day, and Jeremy Corbyn MP stood up and said, fight racism, fight imperialism, fight the BNP, fight UKIP. They're the BNP in blazers. And so I went away from that day with that ringing in my ears, the BNP in blazers. Are the UKIP? Are the UKIP a fascist party? Are they a Nazi party? So basically that's what I'm going to just like talk about. I mean, well, the basic thing that we know about the UKIP is they want to leave the EU. They're anti-Europe. They're anti-European Union. And I mean, the reason why we're talking about them is like, at the beginning of May, in the English County Council elections, UKIP got 147 councillors elected, and they took 23% of the vote. That's like nearly a quarter of the vote. In February, they got nearly 30% of the vote in the Eastleigh by-election. They almost actually got a Member of Parliament in there. Nigel Farage is being courted by the capitalist class. He went for dinner with Rupert Murdoch only a few months ago, and then Rupert Murdoch tweeted on his Twitter account, "Economies are going nowhere. New leaders are emerging on the distant horizon. Stagnant Europe is racked by discontent and resentment of EU. Farage reflecting opinion." So where did the UKIP come from? Well, they were founded in 1993. I mean, it's basically Tory voters, Thatcherites, who were actually opposed to the Maastricht Treaty. That's who really where they're coming from. I mean, they're all Tory voters. European elections in 1999, they got three MEPs, took about 7% of the vote, about 700,000 votes. By 2009, they got 2.5 million votes, they're taking 17% of the vote, and they've got 13 MEPs, so 2.5 million votes. General elections, they're not faring as well, because of obviously the first-past-the-post system is detrimental to smaller parties. They got about 400,000 votes in 2001. By 2010, they were up to, again, nearly a million votes. I mean, the UKIP, the sovereign the voters' feelings of sort of powerlessness and economic insecurity, there's some sort of xenophobia going on here. But they're a party of protest and discontent. You know, they distrust the mainstream political parties, and they sort of tap into an anti-political mood in the country, you know, which is like we get all the expensive scandals and various other things. I mean, what do the capitalists class actually think about leaving the EU? I mean, every time I read about this, they're really against it at the moment. Ford, BMW have warned Cameron against leaving the EU, insisting it would be devastating for the British economy. A poll by the British Chambers of Commerce in April polled 4,380 companies, and that's quite a lot, and they reported that 18% felt leaving the EU would be positive, but 64% actually favoured Cameron renegotiating terms. And 60% felt exiting the EU would harm business. And even 23% of these companies polled actually wanted further integration. And I think even Mortensen, Sorrell and Branson have actually gone on record of saying, you know, we're opposed to leaving the EU. That's how it stands at the moment. I'm sure we've heard a lot of quotes about the UKIP recently. I mean, the Tories have obviously been saying lots of derogatory things about them over the years. Michael Howard referred to them as political cranks, gadflies and extremists. Cameron referred to them as fruitcakes and loonies and closet racists mostly. And that was again reiterated by Kenneth Clarke in this year. He actually said, basically agreed with what Cameron had said about them and added that they were a collection of clowns. Now, I would have brought a copy of Private Eye with me, but I've had a nap this afternoon and I've like rushed out of the house and I forgot to bring the copy. But it's a picture of like a lot of clowns on the front of the Private Eye and it's talking about UKIP clowns. Now, they may be clowns, but these clowns are a threat to the working class. Guardian ICM poll last month put them at 18%. That's above the Liberal Democrats and behind Labour on 34% and the Tories on 28%. So they are a third force in British politics. I referred to the it's BNP in blazers, it's Jeremy Corbyn thing. Now basically, though, Farage has been described as a reactionary throwback. The Kippers, as they're known, the UKIPers, they sort of revere Churchill and Thatcher. I mean, we all know about they want to bring smoking back into pubs. They believe in a small state, low taxes, they're hostile to the EU and immigration. I mean, their constitution actually calls themselves a Democratic Libertarian Party. Farage personally actually supports the decriminalisation of drugs and prostitution. That is his own personal stand on that. That is not the UKIP policy. I mean, they're really a right-wing sort of populist party. I mean, they're against multiculturalism, political correctness, and all the usual things. They want to increase police numbers, double prison places, expand the armed services. I mean, their website quotes Thatcher, where she was actually quoting Dennis Healey, funny enough, the defence budget is one of the very few elements of public expenditure that can be truly described as essential. There was another thing which is quite interesting. The UK actually state they no longer want to involve the UK in military adventurism. Now, there was no expansion of that line, of that phrase, but possibly that is a rejection of the wars of liberal interventionism. So we wouldn't have Iraq, we wouldn't have Afghanistan, we wouldn't have going into Libya last year. But as well as being a sort of a libertarian sort of party, they're also a social conservative party. I mean, they're against gay marriage. I mean, there's elements of homophobia in the party, misogyny. I mean, one UKIP donor last month said that women should wear skirts because it's more pleasing to men. And women in trousers are hostile, and unmarried mothers are naughty girls who need a smack. This is a UKIP donor. He's donating money to the party, and those sort of views will be in the party. I mean, that leading Tory described grassroots Tory activists as mad swivel-eyed loons recently, we'll recall. I mean, that really could apply to the UKIP. Now, as a personal anecdote, I walked into the lounge the other day and there was a TV programme on the television, and there was a bunch of Tory grassroots activists sitting around a table, middle-aged men and women, white middle-aged men and women. I said to Emma, "Oh, are they UKIP?" And she said, "No, they're grassroots Tory activists." I think these are interchangeable. They're the same people, really. UKIP, they deny climate change. They obviously want to end mass immigration. They want to bring in points-based work permit systems. They want to cut foreign aid. And obviously, if they leave the EU, they obviously want to contract free trade deals with other parts of the world, like with the North American Free Trade Association. There's talk of setting up a Commonwealth Free Trade Area. It's like the old imperial preference thing. Their sort of nationalism has been described as civic nationalism, so it's open and inclusive to anyone who wishes to identify with Britain. Now, this will contrast with when I talk about BNP later, which their nationalism obviously is a bit more racial and to do with the blood and soil and other such things. I mean, the UKIP are a party of capitalism. They're into reforming capitalism. They've got a real avowed belief in economic liberalism, laissez-faire capitalism, and they're full of ex-bankers. I mean, Farage himself is a former commodity broker. And one of their main policies is to exclude the city from any EU controls. They're specifically asking for a repeal of a certain directive which actually regulates hedge funds and private equity companies. In the Daily Telegraph on the 1st of June, I noticed an article that Farage had held fundraising dinners for city supporters, and he got a five-figure donation from one ex-chief executive of a FTSE 100 company. So he's busily oiling the wheels on there. They talk about the cuts that the UKIP wants to actually bring in. It says here, the cuts to the public sector, they're so swingeing, they make the Tories' most austere wet dreams look Keynesian. I mean, some of the cuts to taxation and billions of cuts to the public sector to reduce the deficit. I mean, I think the Times pointed out, they called into question some of these figures, and they've highlighted that there's £120 billion black hole in their spending plans. The UKIP's views on workers' rights are a bit dubious as well. I mean, they want to... Basically, they're just an extremist version of the Tory party. They want to reduce the influence of employment tribunals, so there'll be limits on unfair dismissal claims, and they want to scrap most equality and discrimination legislation. I mean, I would want to know what equality and discrimination legislation they want to abolish. They talk about decreasing the power of the trade unions, and they say if private sector workers have to endure pay cuts and job losses during the economic recession, then it's only fair that public sector workers must do the same. and maternity leave. One UKIP MEP feels that women of childbearing age should not be employed because maternity rights are too draconian for employers. On their website, they've got a large essay by their economics guru on taxation. And they are referencing Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, and David Ricardo, The Principles of Political Economy, right at the top of the article. They quote Ricardo saying the taxes on wages will raise wages and therefore will diminish the rate of profit of the stock. A tax on wages is wholly a tax on profits. Now, I just want to bring in what we have to say about this, because we've always argued that taxes are, although some taxes are paid by the working class, the burden of taxation rests on the capitalist class and has to be paid out of the profit accruing to them in the form of rent, interest and profit, the basis of which is the unpaid labour of the working class. It took me a while to actually find out where Marx actually was referring to that, but it seems to be in a newspaper article in 1847 in Brussels. And if all taxes which bear on the working class were abolished root and branch, the necessary consequence would be the reduction of wages by the whole amount of taxes which today goes into them. Either the employer's profit would rise as a direct consequence by the same quantity, or else no more than an alteration in the form of tax collecting would have taken place. Instead of the present system, whereby the capitalist also advances as part of the wage the taxes which the worker has to pay, the capitalist would no longer pay them in this roundabout way, but directly to the state. I mean, the UKIP actually say they want low taxes, fewer regulations and small government as a recipe for a successful economy. They basically want to reduce the taxation on the capitalist class. They want to replace VAT. They want to abolish the national insurance contribution by employers. They want to abolish inheritance tax. I mean, I've just got down here. They want to reduce corporation tax. I mean, all these things are actually coming down under the Tories, but obviously not fast enough for UKIP supporters. I mean, they actually are supporters of the flat tax, which is basically replacing income tax, national insurance and other various forms with a flat rate tax. They say the burden of taxation must be lifted from the middle Britain wealth creators, and they say there's tax avoidance by the capitalist class because rates are too high. I mean, currently, I mean, the top rate of income tax is, what, 45%? I mean, in the 1970s, it was over 90%. And I think corporation tax is down to about 20-odd percent at the moment. I mean, UKIP talk about raising the personal tax-free allowance because it's too low, and basically would take out a lot of low-paid workers out of tax altogether. But basically, what we'd all pay the same amount of... an individual capitalist would pay the same amount of income tax as an individual member of the working class. That is what a flat tax is. It comes from something called the Laffer Curve, which has actually been totally discredited, which comes from a US economist in the 1970s called Arthur Laffer. But basically, he says that a curve on a graph, the tax rates of both 0% and 100% will yield zero revenue, but somewhere in between would be a point which would yield the maximum amount of revenue. I mean, this could be anywhere on the graph, and it's not necessarily 50%. But this Laffer curve is actually behind all the economic policies of the Reagan administration in the 1980s, you know, where basically they were trying to impose a flat rate of tax. Reagan's economy tax cuts legislation reduced corporation taxes, top rates of income tax for the capitalist class, even reduced it for the bottom segment of the population. And basically the net result of all this is like a rise in federal debt. I mean, John Kenneth Galbraith basically just said the Laffer Curve was used to lower the taxes on the affluent. Basically, it's led to more income inequality in capitalism. There's a net increase in poverty in the working class. I mean, the legacy of Reaganomics is homelessness. I mean, these same policies were applied in Chile under Pinochet and also in Britain and other Western countries. Not that they've adopted flat rate taxes, but they've cut the top rates of taxes, and we know what the state of inequality is like in this country now. So the net result, really, of all this, if UKIP was in power, we'd have more influence, more affluence for the capitalist class, more profits would be accrued by the capitalist class. I mean, it's loony right-wing free market capitalism. It's more of the same, but just even worse, I think. I'll go on to talk about... the BNP. Right, well, since I started writing this, things have happened in Woolwich. You know, there's that incident in Woolwich, there's been a rise in... anti-Muslim incidents. You notice UKIP have been very quiet when all this is going on now, because obviously, you know, they want to keep out of it. They don't want to be making any comments about this. But who's come on the scene is like the BNP and the EDL. So what I originally wrote about the BNP was that they peaked and were actually in decline, and I think that is the case. Now, last Saturday, they tried to march from Woolwich to Lewisham, and the Metropolitan Police banned the march and moved them to Westminster. 150 of them turned out. They were actually opposed by approximately 300 anti-fascists, you know, Trotskyites. I noticed SWP were there and even Spew were there. 58 of those were arrested. Now, the English Defence League, again, they were in decline. They were only established a few years ago. But because of this incident in Woolwich, they had a demo in Whitehall a few weeks ago. 1,000 of them turned out. And on the internet, on Facebook, they've got 66,000 ticks. 66,000 people have actually logged onto their site and said, "We like you." That's quite a lot. Now, quickly about the BNP. I mean, I'm sure we all know roughly who they are. I mean, they're Britain's own fascist party. They're our own Nazi party. They're the successor to Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists. They were established in 1982 out of the National Front, which had peaked about 1977. But as I said in that brief talk we had about Thatcher, I think Thatcher, she played the race card just before the general election in 1979, and she pulled a lot of votes that potentially would have gone to the National Front, and they basically imploded at the general election in 1979. The BNP leader in the 80s and 90s was John Tyndall, who was formerly the National Front leader. But since 1999, Nick Griffin has been the leader, and under his leadership, there's been quite a lot of success. I mean, they've had local councillors elected since 2002. They took over half the vote in a Barking election. In 2004, they got 5% of the vote at the European elections. In 2008, they had 55 councillors nationally, and nearly 1 million people voted for them in the European elections. And they got two MEPs elected, including Griffin. And as we all know, in October 2009, 8 million people watched Nick Griffin on BBC One's Question Time. But since that time, there's been a decline. I mean, the general election of 2010, they polled about 500,000 votes, got 2% of the vote, but nobody was elected. And in the local elections of 2010 and 2013, they've lost most of those 55 councillors. I mean, UKIP are a capitalist party with a reformist ideology, although it's a sort of more pure bourgeois political economic viewpoint coming from Adam Smith and David Ricardo, but it's allied with a moralistic social conservatism. Now, the BNP are a little bit different. I mean, they oppose globalisation, internationalism, laissez-faire capitalism. They're just against economic liberalism, Thatcherism, call it what you will. I mean, they're for some sort of economic nationalism. It's autarky is another word for it. I mean, in conjunction with the free trade area, which would include the white Commonwealth. And then they want British ownership of British industries and resources. They want a regeneration of agriculture, self-sufficiency in food production. They talk about renationalising utilities. So basically, they're a state capitalist organisation. They even talk about breaking up private monopolies, prosecuting banksters, as they call them. And they want the city subordinated to the power of central government. I mean, this is totally opposite to what UKIP would want. They even talk about greater share ownership and workers have a stake in companies, cancel house building programmes, and they even talk about privatised social housing stock to be returned to the council ownership. I mean, obviously, they want to reduce the deficit. There's no detail about how they would reduce the deficit. I suppose leaving the EU would save them some money. They oppose the EU, they want to end foreign aid, end participation in wars in Afghanistan. Obviously, they want the end to immigration. But a change in their policies now, they want to finance voluntary repatriation. So it's not compulsory repatriation now, they will finance people to leave the country. Obviously, the usual things that they support are capital punishment, national service, workfare, not welfare. They're a believer in traditional gender roles, family, they oppose abortion. No to civil partnerships, homosexuality to return to the closet, and also their climate change deniers as well. Now, you know, the BNP were criticised back in 2009 on that Question Time programme because they'd hijacked Churchill for their own publicity purposes. I mean, this is just one example of their opportunism. I mean, they are a Nazi party with an anti-Semitic ideology, but they hide it behind some sort of a John Bull British nationalism. I mean, Griffin has criticised the RAF, basically, over the bombing campaign of German cities. He's praised the military prowess of the Waffen-SS. But the most significant opportunism of the BNP in recent years is their anti-Islam campaign, which started before 9/11, interestingly enough, when Griffin became leader. It is his sort of like campaign. Now, the campaign, it still continues, was actually criticised by the former leader, John Tyndall, on the grounds that my enemy's enemy is my friend. We shouldn't be, you know, the BNP shouldn't be opposing Muslims and Islam because they're the enemy of Jews and Zionists. How's that? I don't know. Have I talked for long enough? How's people?
Carry on.
I just feel like I've been talking for too long, but maybe I'm just going off on a tangent a little bit. But yeah, it's just interesting, the sort of like the state capitalism of the BNP. I mean, it comes out of left-wing Nazism, which was actually a strand of political thought in the Nazi Party in the 1920s. And it was basically a product of two brothers called Otto and Gregor Strasser. So it was known as Strasserism. And basically, it was a sort of a working-class-based form of Nazism. I mean, it was hostile to Jews from an anti-capitalist angle. I mean, they rejected a parliamentary approach. A lot of their support was in the working class, in unemployed workers, the so-called dangerous class, the lumpen proletariat. So the Strassers and the Brown Shirts actually basically wanted some sort of second revolution. After the Nazis come to power, they wanted to remove all the elites from power and they would become a new elite. Now, obviously, this proletarianism actually frightened the property classes in Germany, and Hitler actually dealt with it after he came to power, and basically a lot of people were killed in something called the Night of the Long Knives, which took place in 1934. But this left-wing strand of Nazism actually has its roots in the Nazi Party programme from 1920, which basically they talked about the abolition of unearned income, the breaking of debt interest slavery, the nationalisation of associated industry, division of profits in every industries. And this was written by their economist, Gottfried Feder. He talked about breaking the shackles of interest. They saw financial capitalism as the root of all society's problems. Not capitalism itself, but just financial capitalism. And also they were obviously in favour of small businesses as opposed to large-scale capitalist concerns. We in the SPGB have always pointed out that this opposition to unearned income was actually was an opposition of the German capitalist class to foreign capitalists actually raking off proceeds from German industry, which was actually what was taking place after the First World War. I may go off on another tangent here briefly. In the struggle against the Weimar Republic, the left-wing Nazis actually advocated class struggle and strikes. And what you get is, we're like last Saturday, we got the BNP being opposed by 300 anti-fascists. What actually happened in the last few years of the Weimar Republic, even though on the streets the Nazis and the communists were actually fighting each other, what actually happened, we had actually collaboration between the German Communist Party and the Nazi Party in its opposition to the Weimar Republic, all part of the Third International's doctrine of the Third Period, which was something they agreed at the World Congress in 1928, which basically said that capitalism was going into crisis and the end of capitalism was actually in sight, and that social democrats, social democracy, like Labour parties, were seen as the main enemy. They were described as social fascists. So not Nazis, but social fascism was actually what was preventing the proletariat actually achieving victory. So this strategy meant that the communists would not make any alliance with social democracy, i.e. the social democrats in Germany, but they actually would work with the Nazis. I mean, Tolman of the KPD, German Communist Party, actually said, after the fascists, come we. After Hitler, our turn. So they're actually willing to let Hitler take power, because they actually believed that that would lead to the proletarian revolution. As you know, it didn't. Palm Dutt, who's a British communist, he was still writing in 1934, or a year after the Nazis came to power, and after communists and social democrats had actually been imprisoned. It would be more correct to say of social democracy and fascism, their aims are the same, the saving of capitalism from the working class revolution. They differ only in their methods. So he's still saying things like that, even after a year of Nazism. When the Nazis attempted to set up their own sort of workers' trade union, this is before they took power, I'm talking about, called the Nazi Factory Cell Organization. Interesting enough, the German Communist Party referred to Nazis as working people's comrades. Tolman referred to the brown shirts as Nazi prolets, Nazi proletarians. So both the Communist Party and the Nazis actually hated the Weimar Republic. And basically, blocks of working class votes would shift between the Nazis and the Communists in different elections. Ruth Fischer, as a leading Communist Party activist in Germany, addressed a group of nationalist students in Berlin in these last few days of the Weimar Republic. And she said, "Who comes into resistance against the Jewish capital is a class warrior. Trample these Jewish capitalists, hang them on lampposts, smash them and break them." Now, this is from the German Communist Party. Tolman said in 1932, we're coming into the last few months now of the bourgeois democracy, he said, "When strikes are being organised in firms and companies, it is absolutely essential and desirable that Nazis are invited to take part in the strike committees." I did, again, because I rushed out of the house, I forgot to bring something with me, but I found on the internet a picture of a working class tenement houses in Berlin. There was a municipal rent strike in 1932-33, obviously working class people refusing to pay rents. And it was supported by both the Nazis and the Communists, and there's the Nazi swastika flags hanging out of windows right next door to Communist hammer and sickle flags. It's quite interesting. I mean, they actually collaborated over a transport strike in Berlin in the last few days before Hitler took power. I mean, we've got Communists and Nazis fighting the police in a four-day transport strike. And I was going to even quote Goebbels here. Goebbels even said, "Many bourgeois sectors will be scared away by our participation in this transport strike, but that is not decisive. These sectors can be won back easily. But if we lose the worker, he will be lost for good." So the Nazis courting the working class. I mean, the Nazi BNP state capital is just, as we would say in the party, it's reformist eyewash. I mean, the Nazis, BNP, EDL, they're all products, parties of discontent. I mean, the crisis of capitalism in the early 30s shaped political mass opinion in support of a party of reaction. The Nazis were a product of wild despair and wild hope. I mean, a lot of leftists actually believe that fascism is the last refuge of the capitalist class defending itself against the working class. And we don't see it like that. I mean, it is just another form of bourgeois rule. It is a reform movement of capitalism, of national consolidation, but with working class support. And I think the Golden Dawn in Greece, I mean, they sort of support that sort of argument. They're a reform movement to capitalism, but with working class support, and they're gaining ground. So UKIP, they're a populist right-wing capitalist reform party. The BNP, they're Nazi state capitalism. I mean, that would be the wages system, literally under new management. They're just alternative ways to manage capitalism. I mean, I was listening to Radio 4, and some pundit was talking, and the question was, is Nigel Farage a fascist? And they said, no, he's not Mussolini. He hasn't got the grandiose idea. Somewhere else I read, UKIP, they're more Enoch Powell than Oswald Mosley. Which I think that's more appropriate than anything I've said earlier. So socialism is the only remedy for fascism. It's the only remedy for capitalism. And the SPGB has never shied away from debating with and pointing out the failure of reformists like Mosley, the NF or UKIP to solve the problems the working class face in capitalism. BNP in blazers. Not really. But we should oppose them anyway. How about that?
Thanks. Who wants to contribute or make a question, I think?
Thank you for that, Steve. Okay. First of all, UKIP, they have been in the news quite recently, but they've also been out of the news more recently.
Yes.
And it seemed to strike me that it was very similar to that of the Green Party when they came to prominence. Everyone seemed to love them, voted for them. And then they seem to disappear or, you know, they're still hanging around. Can I ask, even though socialists aren't interested in age, can I ask what the median age group of this UKIP party is? Is it elder people? Are they across the range? Do they have young people who go along with these views?
Yeah. Okay, anything else?
Yes, there's two other things. If Murdoch supports UKIP, then surely they've got into power.
Yeah, I'm glad you can't.
I would have thought. Yeah. And the other thing is, if UKIP is so grassroots Tories, if you use that term, Say there was like Liberal Democrats and Conservative, hung Parliament, where they've got to merge to get into power, the two of them. If UKIP went in with the Conservatives, as they seem to be the same people, would UKIP, become submerged in the Conservative Party, or would the Conservative Party take on board UKIP? If you can answer those questions, thank you. as briefly as possible.
Yeah. Since that incident in Woolwich, UKIP have been out of the news, and I think that's a deliberate policy. I would have thought they just don't want to be talking about it, don't want to have any discussion about it, because the only people who are talking about it are fascists and Nazis and the EDL and the BNP. You know, they're the ones getting worked up about it. So they've sort of like stepped back. I just think that's just temporary. Once the political climate sort of like calms down a bit, you know, and this incident in Woolwich becomes a distant memory, then, you know, various other things will crop up and UKIP will come to the fore again. I mean, they've been on a, I mean, the county council elections were only the first, well, only the 2nd of May. It's only the 4th of June. It's only 4 weeks ago, the county council elections. So they've only really been out of the news frame maybe for just since the incident in Woolwich, say, a couple of weeks. So in reference to the Green Party, probably the Green Party, they've sort of maybe blown it in a way. I mean, we've got sort of climate deniers in the climate change deniers in the Tory Party. So I think the consensus almost is that climate change is like a sort of a fallacy. But I mean, that's another talk in itself, isn't it? The Green Party. I mean, somebody else maybe want to talk about the Green Party, but I don't really know where they are at all now. You know. Murdoch, if Murdoch supports UKIP, then UKIP get power. Yeah, I've actually thought that myself. I mean, all you have to do is have the Sun newspaper, which has 3-4 million working class readers, say you vote UKIP, and they'll go and vote UKIP. I mean, am I overstressing the influence of the media there? But the thing about grassroots activists and UKIP being submerged in the Tory party or vice versa. I mean, Farage is on record as saying we're not a party of government, we're a party of protest, and we want to change the Tory party.
He said that.
I mean, I know he's a politician, he's got to want power. He may say he doesn't want power, but I believe he must want power. And I mean, there's already talk about there's certain Tory MPs are willing to willing to stand down and have UKIP candidates placed in their constituencies if they're safe Tory seats. They're willing to stand down and have a UKIP candidate in there, and the UKIP then will be elected to Parliament. And also people like Nadine Dorries, these sort of right-wing Tory MPs, are quite UKIP-friendly anyway. So I think they just want to push the Tory party further to the political right. That's my belief. And also going by what he says, he doesn't want power and he just wants to influence the agenda.
Right. Yes. Always chance in the next election. Have you got much chance in the next election?
Well, when's the next election? 2015? What are we now? 2013? We've got 2 years, haven't we?
Long 2 years
is, as we know, is a really long time. Yeah. I don't know, there's lots going to happen, isn't it, before then? I mean.
You see, the manifesto there is, it's something for everyone.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it's populism, isn't it? Yeah. It's populism, yeah. But it's a hard line, though, isn't it?
It's, I don't see it as anti-Tory, but it's all things to all people. The Liberals used to be. The Liberals done it, and then Lib Dems done it quietly in constituencies, you know, put one thing in one place, next brother were different. But Farage seems to be doing it up front, you know.
Yeah.
Roll up, you know, I've got for you. You don't like this, you don't go, oh, fix that, fix this.
Yeah, but well, when we went to the hustings in Brixton, in Brixton Hill in January, the UKIP candidate basically was just saying, if in doubt, we'll have a referendum on it. If in doubt, we'll have a local referendum. You want speed bumps removed from your road, we'll have a referendum on it. You want to like keep your library open, we'll have a referendum on it. It was like referenda, left, right and centre, plebiscites, you know. But But anything that, you know, let the people decide. Yeah, no. But basically, when you do look at what they actually want, they want a really, really unrestricted sort of capitalism, and they are proposing this flat tax. I mean, this flat tax exists in places like the Ukraine and Estonia, Lithuania. They have these sort of like low rates of tax, personal income tax, 13%. Everybody pays 13% of their wages in tax. So, I mean, but the flat tax has been rejected.
Non-wage workers, income.
Well, they'll be on workfare, won't you? They won't even be in the tax bracket, will they? And probably you'd have the vote taken away from you eventually.
They're going to have a conference.
What, UKIP?
Yeah.
I think they have a conference. I think they have a national conference, don't they? Yeah.
Well, did they join in October in the season?
Yeah. After
the course.
Yeah. I mean, they've got about, I believe they've got about 30,000 members.
Branches in there.
Yeah, they're probably, I mean, they've been around since 1993. I mean, they've got 20 years
to,
you know.
It's a lot of people, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think my point is, I walked into the lounge and I saw these people on television and I thought they were UKIP activists and they were actually grassroots local Tory activists. I couldn't tell the difference, and I don't think you can.
But, I mean, I don't think UKIP's got any chance of winning the election or even getting many MPs. They might do well in next year's European elections.
Yeah,
it's judge European elections. Nothing's at stake. You can do.
Yeah.
But if UKIP did travel, or the Tory party did adopt UKIP's policy, they'd lose the next election. I mean, I think, in fact, if you want to go in for conspiracy theories, that the media, generally middle of the road, left wing, liberal, metrosexuals, whatever they all are, and they are building up UKIP because they want to split the Tories so that Labour and the Liberals get back in again. I heard a Green Party person complaining that all this publicity about UKIP, for and against, that's why they got a lot of votes, because they had any publicity at all for, UKIP had a part of little broadcast every day of the week. It must be in the interest of the Labour Party and people that sympathise with the Labour Party to build up UKIP.
It's going to split the
Tories. And a policy like that will never get majority support. I mean, under capitalism now, they've reached a stage where you get these middle-road people I don't think UKIP, I think it's a bubble. I think it'll disappear in the next general election. You might see it expand again in the in the European elections. But after that,
but a lot of it's so contradictory. I mean, immigration, they're opposed to any immigration, but British capitalism, industrial or social or whatever it is, relies a tremendous on cheap immigration labour. Who's going to collect the shrimps from Morecambe Bay if it's not the
Chinese?
It's just ridiculous. But as regards to them merging, bringing the Conservative Party into the UKIP camp or the opposite, aren't they both in the same camp, really? It's just a branch of can you be a member of UKIP and the Conservative Party?
I wouldn't have thought so.
It's a separate party, isn't it?
It is a separate party, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's... the separation is not permanent, I think. The separation is... semi-detached, I think. There's a hell of a lot there. But it's sort of kind of romantic, isn't it? And going back, it's sort of... It's idealistic in the sense that it's totally... It's totally inoperable at all their aims. Though some of them could be very popular and they could get a lot of support for some of their aims from the workers, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
It's not really... Would you say they're supported by working class people?
What, UKIP?
the professional part.
I suppose there is in a percentage, but really, yeah. It's like you said, the dissatisfied laser wearers with their cricket club, aren't they?
Well, that's the British Legion, more likely.
Yeah,
that sort of thing.
Well, 30% of the vote in Eastleigh, in Hampshire, which is an old railway town. You know, there's a lot. There's,
that's 30% of those who voted.
30% of those who turned out
if
to vote.
10% voted, then it's still
more than 10%.
Yeah, well, it was an Eastleigh by-election. It was a very high-profile by-election. I don't know what the turnout was, but... But they nearly won that seat. I mean, they got 30%, almost 30% of the vote, and it's an old working class town, which for some reason Labour have never really had very much success in, which is a bit peculiar. But old railway workers there, which is what good skilled working class trades.
And, I think old working class industrial working class towns, they grasp at anything.
Yeah.
They don't grasp at anything. If they can get an MP who shout on their behalf, they'll vote for it.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's not based on any real fundamental understanding.
It's Tory voters. It's disgruntled Tory voters who obviously opposed the integration into the EU, the Maastricht Treaty. It's basically the roots
again,
of it.
That's kind of, cutting your nose off a spiky face, isn't it, really? The membership of the European Union is a tremendously large section of the British exports. It's so much really a part of interchangeable in the rules and the laws and civil liberties. It's hard to do that. It'd be unthinkable.
Yeah, but the Tory party are promising all this referendum in order to try and get UKIP votes back. But, I mean, I don't think the Tories are going to win the next election, so there's not going to be a referendum.
No.
You know? I mean, the Tory party hasn't won an election since John Major.
No.
1992.
I mean, if they swing back to this sort of thing, they'll go into opposition again. So,
what will there be? A gathering together, the Liberals, the reminder of the Liberals and the Labour Party. I see that Balls of the Labour prospective Chancellor at least, wants to do with that. He wants a sort of means test before they let you have a winter fuel allowance.
We're all right.
For the rich.
None of us here pay 40%, 45% income tax, do we?
Yeah.
So, it's the others.
Someone can pop their head up and say, yeah, but look, this person is, these people, they don't work, they're the children. They are either hangers on of royalty, or they're tax eaters connected with the government, or they're just the children and relatives of zillionaires who are making money from the business. They're not getting the thing about working for the country, and they're still lapping up £200, £300, £400 every year for their winter fuel. Mind you, the houses their size and the cost of food, their cash bills, they need it.
Well, they're spending
much as she's spending the council for that, but it's very difficult for the government to administer fairly, in their terms of fairness, taxation, because without an intense examination of everyone's income, and that's not, I don't think it's...
Well, I thought it just said that it'll deny it to people that pay the 45%... income tax, so they've got a list of those people anyway, so when they're sending it out, they'll send it out to everybody else except them. So I mean, it wouldn't necessarily involve a big means test. They just say, if you're a higher rate taxpayer, you won't get it.
They probably wouldn't miss it either.
I didn't understand that.
Well, I think that's good.
Yeah.
But about I think you're right, but you know, the BNP is making more of an appeal to workers than the than UKIP. I mean, this in these council elections last year, they were fighting on Save the City. I mean, look at their candidates. This man is a qualified barrister who works in the City of London.
That is UKIP.
This is UKIP chairman. David has been in London business for 30 years, first as a city financial futures dealer, and then this man was an electrician, apparently. But this woman here came from a mining town in the northeast, and she now runs her own multinational private shipping enterprise. So, Elizabeth Jones
is a
partner of a leading London law firm, and then this Paul Oakley, he's another. He used to work for Bill Cash, and he's got a practicing barrister. So, I mean, these are sort of big ones. Yeah, it's not the A's, it's top hats, you know. I mean,
yeah.
it's top hats.
Ridiculous.
But this woman, Elizabeth Jones, she was in the by-election, we contested in Brixton. She was their candidate. Mm. And she's just an idiot.
One who was doing that.
Yeah, she spoke with a stupid upper-class accent.
In Sloane Square, when she was hustled.
And she was saying silly things and getting the whole audience was laughing at her. But I mean, UKIP didn't get many more votes than us. You know, we got 32, they got 46. I mean, UKIP is no threat in big cities like London. All these county council elections, you know, where they've never seen a black person or anything like that. You know,
exactly.
That's the sort of area where they got support. But in the big city, they don't do any good at all in the north of England. Just, as you said, branch of the breakaway Tories or dissident Tories. But people do. I mean, you know, we went down last weekend to the West Country, for a wedding. There was one ex-soldier going on saying, "Yeah, UKIP's going to do this and all that sort of thing." And then in the pub, there's people talking about UKIP. So people are still talking about it. You know, it's a subject of conversation. But one of them was saying, even if they get to power, they won't withdraw from the common market. They'll just be like all the others.
Yeah, he's probably right.
But having said that, I think what is behind the UKIP thing is dissatisfaction of all politicians.
Yeah.
And there's nothing the Conservative Party can do. They can do this, they can do that. These people that vote for UKIP will still be discontented because they're discontented with...
Hope triumphing over experience, as far as people supporting the latest so-called revolutionary or reformist organisation. You see them, they sort of rise up, and then it's like they're the storms, the battlements of capitalism, all their spears blunt, trying to get through the wall, because their concept of their mindset is not such that they can really conceive of a fundamental change of the relationship of everyone to wealth. So
I think there must be old people if they want to go back to parking charges, smoking in pubs, bringing back banning homosexuality and things. I mean, there must be people in the 60s or something, or 70s. In fact, if they want to go back to Britain of the 1950s, why don't they go and live on the Isle of Man or something like that?
Or the Isle of Wight.
Isle of Man, New Zealand, So, I mean, passing phrase,
I forgot to answer your question on the age.
It's an SBGB. I think you didn't bother with that.
I forgot about it. No, but I think the Isla, as Adam pointed out, it is an older electorate that actually support them. I mean, I got a figure the other day that in the 18 to 34 year old bracket, I mean, most of those people, young people in their 20s and 30s, early 30s, support the membership of the EU. I mean, the majority. I mean, no. These sort of groups of people are never even looked at. It's always the middle age, isn't it? And the elderly seem to be what everybody seems to be targeting. But the young people, I think young people, they haven't got these issues with Europe.
But do they understand the issues?
Well,
it's not the point.
They don't want to go back. I mean, they might just accept things as they are, but they don't want to go back.
So the median age of the party probably is 55, as I should think, and probably could be older.
But there are many men as well.
Yes. Yeah.
But I mean, talking about young people, I think that even in Scotland, they've discovered that the SNP decided they wanted to have younger people from 16 having the vote, and they discovered that people from 16 to 18 are more opposed to Scottish independence than
16.
So people don't like this sort of backward-looking narrow nationalism stuff, which is good in a sense. But
a lot of people support UKIP because they believe that Europe's shortfall of mass immigration was seen as political lines. Lithuanians from other parts of the EU,
I
think. If you pull out the EU, then we
wouldn't
have these migrants. Well,
that reminds me of another pub conversation I overheard in a pub, which was a pub in Kingston, and one of them was speaking, he was a Greek Cypriot or something. Anyway, he was talking to a Geordie. And this Geordie was talking about the KIP party. Skip party. No, it's a UKIP party. Anyway, one of them was assuring the other, there's a million Romanians. They've already got their visas. They're coming here next January. Nobody believed this. And he said, I used to vote Liberal, but now I'm going to vote UKIP.
Yeah. I mean, the UKIP, I think in Eastleigh or one of these other by-elections, they actually put out literature saying so many million Bulgarians and Romanians were actually coming to the country, and basically all they'd done was added up the population of Bulgaria and Romania, and then they'd added those figures together and give this as a figure for the amount of immigration that was about to arrive on these shores. And then put that on a leaflet.
300 million Europeans could come to Britain.
Technically, you're right. Technically.
Is it still the case today, if anyone knows or is aware, that more people leave Britain every day than actually come into the country?
That's true. Some.
I mean, there is a emigration. Yeah. I don't know how many.
Cagey about that figure.
Sorry.
We're very cagey about that.
What, the ones that leave?
Aye.
Because I know it does.
You don't get a clear answer. You see, people who weren't here anyway, they just came and were passing through. And a few tourists and a few retirees from Spain. The figures jumbled,
This drunken Scotsman we met in the pub in West Country.
He changed his vote.
No. He said, I worked in Germany. And he said, all these British building workers working in. In Germany, it must have been a few years ago, I suppose.
That's 20 years ago.
Well, no, he said he was the only one that could speak German, therefore he became the foreman or something. Yeah, and the British workers have gone to work in another country, so it's that's what the free movement of labour is in the single market.
That's the contradiction. Yes.
What I like about the idea of the European Union is that you could, in theory, drift around. You got a bit of language and you can work it while sit in the sunshine more than you can here. But mainly that there's no way, especially if they get a sort of more federal arrangement, there's no way a European country in the UK, in the European Union would dream of starting a war against another country. It'd just be unthinkable now, wouldn't it? I mean, there'd be struggle between sort of minorities and stuff, but there's no way a European country of any size is going to start a war against another member. It just wouldn't. I don't think people would stand for it because it's not what the political climate would allow them. And certainly if their capitalist class interests are all merged together, they wouldn't be sufficiently they couldn't possibly efficiently make a killing by killing, because they've already got fingers level, capital being free to move around, half the public utilities in half the countries in Europe are owned by other countries like Santa, there. My water supply is owned by
EDF or EDL.
The freedom to move of capital is quite an interesting development, isn't it?
But I suppose it
goes with the free movement of labour too.
Absolutely.
What did you think about that?
It's the contradiction, isn't it, you referred to earlier, you know. I mean, they want all this libertarianism, economic liberalism, but at the same time they want to stop immigration. It's just totally contradictory. It's illogical, isn't it? And the EU was, the EEC as it was established basically to stop all war, wasn't it? Basically, it was to where everybody working together.
Massacre everywhere else.
But the Europe, to no more wars on the European mainland, you know. That's why there was such a shock in 1991 when the Yugoslavian thing came up, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't there nowhere. They weren't part of the EU, but it was on the European mainland. I mean, there'd been no war on the European mainland since 1945. So, I mean, the EU is basically that, isn't it? It's to stop basically France and Germany going to war. That's what was the initial.
Well, it was in itself the lines of convenience between German industry, French agriculture, and Italian labour. Well, seriously, I don't think it needs to become a federal state. I mean, they can do all right as they are now. It's just have a single market when they try to have a level playing field for competition between capital for different parts of the area.
Slightly off the point, but on the point. Turkey, is it not in the... I thought it was in the European Union, but I heard on LBC last night that they're not.
No,
they've got some associated agreement.
Yeah. They've been trying.
How many countries are in the European Union now? Can anyone give me a rough estimate?
Well, I've got 27.
27?
Still around there.
Hmm. Well, there's a few more ones to come in. Croatia wants to come in.
Yeah.
Slovenia's
in the Euro, in fact.
I don't think Turkey is really it's a Muslim country. It's ruled by the dictatorial group and it's on the verge of going through the African spring.
But Britain favours Turkey joining Europe's official government policy because they want to weaken Europe. But on the other hand, if Europe's going to become a super state, it'd be quite useful to have Turkey in, because if you've then got a big area into the Middle East and so on. You know.
Turkey couldn't meet the European Union standards of law or freedom.
I would have thought that Turkey was a better bet than Romania and Bulgaria with the basket states.
Yeah.